Look at every war fought in the last 200 years between strong and weak combatants, Goliath won in 72% of the cases. Did you know that? But Davids can win overwhelmingly if they capitalize on their status as an underdog. Here's what we know. In the biblical story, David initially borrows Saul's armor, putting on a coat of mail and a bronze helmet and strapping a sword across his chest. In other words, David at first prepares to engage in a conventional battle between equals, meeting Goliath on the giant's terms. But the sunburned young herdsman must have looked ridiculous, because after he suited up, little David says to his patron, "I can't even walk with these on, much less fight anyone." So, David removes his era's customary defenses, drops the weapon that his opponent will be using, and chooses instead 5 smooth stones from the riverbed, placing them in his shepherd's bag. Importantly, David's slingshot is a devastating tactic, one of the most feared weapons in the ancient world, with the stopping power of, get this, a 45 caliber pistol. And David himself is fast, moving toward Goliath while running, while the giant lumbers in procession behind his shield bearer for protection or guidance or both. Moreover, the giant is unable to accurately size up the agile slinger. Goliath sees sticks, yet apparently there are none, so David literally exposes how a bully can be blind. David turns speed and small stature to his advantage, nailing the giant with a rock in the middle of the forehead, knocking his larger-than-life foe to the ground. Oh, little David. Using David's success as inspiration, political scientist Ivan Aragon Toft looked at 2 centuries of armed conflict. And guess what he discovered? When underdogs acknowledge their weaknesses and choose an unconventional strategy, their winning percentages rise from 28 to 64. Did you hear that? 64%, that's stunning. When the so-called weak opponent chooses not to play by the strong man's rules, he or she wins more than half the time. Well, I don't know about you, but I think in this day and age, in this country, in this city, we need a new playbook. We live in an era when values seem to be challenged every day, when notions of weakness and conventions of strength are being redefined. Sometimes you've just got to change your tactics. Come on, little David. What can we do? What are you going to do? Well, I believe this parable has something to say to us. Consider the story of a scrappy basketball team which won against a league of Goliaths. When Vivek Ranadive decided to coach his daughter Anjali's basketball team, he settled on 2 principles. The first was that he would never raise his voice. This was National Juniors, the Little League of basketball, and he knew from experience that 12-year-olds do not respond well to shouting. Now, some of you parents might not believe that, but it's true. So he would speak calmly, softly, and convince the girls of the wisdom of his approach with appeals to reason and common sense. 8th grade girls, reason and common sense. He was nothing if not hopeful. The second principle was even more important. Ranadive was puzzled by the way Americans play basketball. He's from Mumbai, where he grew up with cricket and soccer, and he would never forget the first time that he saw a basketball game. He thought it was nutty, mindless. Team A would score, and then immediately retreat to its own end of the court. Team B would inbound the ball and dribble into Team A's end, where Team A was patiently waiting. Then the process would reverse itself. Now, a basketball court is 94 feet long, but most of the time a team defends only about 24 feet of the area, conceding the other 70 feet. Occasionally, teams would play a full court press, but by and large, they would do it only for a few minutes and give up. It was as if there was a conspiracy in the basketball world about the way that the game ought to be played, Rondavi thought to himself, and that widened the gap between the good teams and the bad teams. Good teams, after all, had players who were tall and could dribble and shoot well, and they could crisply execute their carefully prepared plays in their opponent's end of the court. But why did weak teams play in a way that made it easy for good teams to do the very things that made them so good? Rondavi looked at his girls. Two of them, Morgan and Julia, were serious basketball players. But Nikki, Angela, Donnie, Holly, Anika, and his own daughter, Anjali, had never played the game before. They weren't that tall. They couldn't shoot. They weren't particularly good at dribbling. They were not the sort of kids, let's face it, who played pickup games on at the playground every evening. Rather, they were the sort of kids who would be called bookworms. They worked on science project posters over the weekend, and they dreamed of being biologists. And Rondavi knew that if they played the conventional way, if they let their opponents dribble the ball up the court without opposition, they would almost certainly lose. Now, Rondavi was not one to accept losing easily. He came to America as a 17-year-old with $50 in his pocket. His second principle then was that his team of little squirrely girls, which is what he called them, would play a real full-court press every game, all the time. And it worked. His team met one formidable foe after another, taller, stronger, and faster than any of the girls on his squad. But his girls, you see, they were scrappy and relentless. From the moment of the first tip-off to the final buzzer, they never let up. And the team, his team of squirrely girls, made it to the national championship. It was really weird, his daughter said later. We didn't know what we were doing, and after we got to the championships, our dad admitted to us that he'd never played basketball before. David beat Goliath. Working hard, consistently, and over time may be actually the rarest gift of all. Effort may really triumph over skill. And what about the underdog? She wins by breaking with convention, by surprising her opponent, by thinking and acting in unexpected ways. So when you're sidelined for whatever reason, you can fume about your bad luck, or you can use your uncomfortable, unwanted vantage point to help you see the game with a new set of eyes. But we don't raise our children to be underdogs much, do we? We're more likely to raise them to be alpha dogs. We're more likely to aspire to be alpha dogs ourselves, and I wonder about the wisdom of that choice. How many of the men who are here today were raised with these time-tested, time-honored orders passed down through generations of fathers and sons? Be number one. Never need an eraser, do it right the first time. Win. Use your head. Don't cry. Never quit. Hit first. Work like hell. Never back off. Fight to the finish. Be a man. And what about the conventions that we project onto our girl children? Be perfect. Be clever. Be strong and beautiful. And perhaps those hard-nosed doctrines propelled many of us to achieve academically and athletically and professionally. But this superficial tough talk, it doesn't teach us anything about how to create and preserve a marriage. It doesn't tell us how to understand our children. It doesn't show us how to reach out to others, how to be patient, find peace, make love. Rather, it's when we're navigating the valleys, developing a sense of humor about ourselves, honestly dealing with the challenges that life has given us. That's what makes us supple, and I would argue that's what makes us really strong. And ironically enough, it's the people who've had the most success or an especially easy go of it that turn out to be the most fragile of all. So let's consider the underdog, the one least likely, the last and the lost. What can each of us learn from the weak parts of ourselves? And if that hits too close to home this morning, think about the systems around you and look at how they are weak. And then after you digest that, let yourself have the courage to look at how you share that kind of weakness. The struggling and the slogging through, the failing and the dying that, let's face it, never makes it into our alumni notes. Jesus was an underdog, or at least he understood them well. Just listen to his most famous address. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are those who seek peace. He said that we need to be reconciled to each other as a first priority, that we need to make amends whenever we wrong someone, that we need to put the other fellow first, and to love our enemies like a father who's found his long-lost son. These are instructions for dogs who know something about loss. In fact, following Jesus doesn't sound like winning in any conventional way. And I guess alpha dogs scoff at the statement, "The last shall be first." But I think it has something to do with recognizing real human value, knowing that whatever a person looks like or wherever she came from or however far one may rise or fall, that he's a child of God and that our destiny is wrapped up in his. It's from our deep desire for connection and affection that I believe is ultimately more valuable, that we ultimately value it more than being out in front. It's from the discovery that human thriving depends on the health of the whole and the wisdom born of suffering with somebody else. Seen this way, every David and every Goliath has gifts to offer and grace to receive. And I say it that way because we need to hear the full truth of this story. There's some Goliaths in this room today. We got to pay attention to their ways that each of us has Goliath inside us too. We want to be David the underdog, but there's a fuller story, I think, if we let it digest in us. And all that's got to change and grow as well. Come on, little David. If you've ever made a graph of your life, writing your birthday on the left side of the page and today's date on the right, filling in the major events that have made you who you are, then you're likely to note that the spikes in your pain bear some relation to the leaps in your growth. It was when your family moved for the fourth time in 5 years that you learned to enjoy your own company in the months before you made new friends at school. It was when your partner left that you remembered what else you meant to do in your life beyond staying together. It was when the doctor called about the spot on your lung that you finally made up with your sister. These are not the ways that you would have chosen to become more than you are, but they worked. All of us have strange imaginings, and the strangest of all is a belief that we can progress only by success and improvement. The wise ones realize, however, that we're much more in need of the stripping off that comes with failure than of the adding on that follows success. As it turns out, losing loosens our grip on the way we understand ourselves and the world so that both can be remade into something better and more solid. Loss can help us find some unaccustomed strength and help us find at last what we truly value. Because it's by living and loving as Jesus, suffering with others so that all may rise, that we may lose a battle every now and then, But in the process, we'll find God, and God will find us. Amen.